Welcome to the Wellness Renaissance Podcast, exploring topics to help you find the pieces that fit into your health puzzle.
It also manifests a lot in daily life by men having no idea how much women are adjusting based on those expectations. I went home one day, after like 2 years into doing this work, and said to Shannon, "Have you ever noticed that some men just don't take women very seriously?" And she, her face, like in half a second, her face registered gratitude, rage, disgust, like, and a whole bunch of other things. Because, you know, she was, and she told me later, she was like, "I was so happy to hear you say that out loud, and just so pissed off that it had taken you so long to see it." You know, so I asked her that, and her response was, "Yes, I've noticed that." You know, and I thought I was really identifying something. But I've never been afraid that a guy might kill me because I undermine his sense of masculinity. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of women who are very, very careful in how they speak to men, especially men they don't know, because they have to be. That doesn't mean that all men are bad. Doesn't mean that all men are evil or violent. It means there is enough of an established pattern of men punishing women for undermining men's masculinity that that's a daily part of pretty much every woman's life, is being conscious of the men around them and picking up on cues whether or not they're conscious of doing that.
Hello and welcome to the Wellness Renaissance Podcast. This is Judy. The voice you just heard was Chris Godsey, and we are going to spend some time today talking about a little bit about the programs that are going on in Duluth, Minnesota, around the support of ending domestic violence and supporting the people who have used or been affected by domestic violence and supporting them in moving forward in different ways. So we're going to learn a little bit about Men as Peacemakers, which is where he is currently working with a program called Domestic Violence Restorative Circles, and some of the other programs they have there at Men as Peacemakers, and also shares about his experience as a co-facilitator leading men's groups at the Domestic Violence Intervention Program, which is where I met him shortly after I started there co-facilitating men's groups. I had the pleasure of working with him as well. So he helped usher me gracefully into this work, and as you will get a taste of, was and continues to be a very insightful mentor. One of the things that you're going to hear is he shares a lot about his perspective and his process to that perspective about our culture and hierarchy and how do we navigate that. And his ability to be open and self-honest and self-critical is what I think makes him so amazing for the work that he is doing in the supportive role that he is. And certainly I saw that in the men's group that we facilitated together. So there's some great food for thought in here. And he shares kind of how he navigates the world when it comes to being in situations where maybe the conversation gets uncomfortable or somebody says something that might be hurtful or disrespectful or sexist. He walks through his communication process and how he thinks about things in those situations to try to make the communication more, or maybe I should say less confrontational, so that it might result in less defensiveness and maybe an opportunity for hearing each other and more consideration. That will all make sense to you by the end. Before we dive in, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you so much to the people who are supporters of the podcast, whether you are somebody that shares the podcast or the episode with somebody that you think might be interested, or perhaps you're one of the Amazon shoppers that heads on over to the wellnessrenpodcast.com website and clicks into one of our Amazon links before you make one of your grand purchases. Thank you so much. Know that it doesn't cost you an actual penny at all. It is just part of your purchase. Thank you so much. And of course, those of you who are supporting us on Patreon, you absolutely have a special place in our hearts. Thank you for being one of the people that support the work that I'm trying to do here of helping get information out to you and others to help them find more options that help put their health and wellness puzzle together. And this, you know, this is a topic about our community. This is not just our own physical body, but it is our community. It's our neighbors. It's how we function as a town, as a community, out to the bigger picture, into the country and the world, right? Ripples. That's how things go. So thank you so much to the people who understand how much work this is, how much it means to me, and to help us keep it growing. So thank you. And quite literally, Judy needs to eat. As much as I keep trying to avoid it, what can I say? So for all of you, thank you, thank you, thank you. On that note, I am excited to bring this conversation to you today. I hope you enjoy it and find hope and encouragement in it like I do. Here's Chris Godsey.
Hey, Judy.
Good to have you. I'm excited to talk to you because this is I've been wanting to talk to somebody about this for a really long time.
Yeah, and my ego likes being asked to talk. And I like visiting with you, so I was happy to be asked. Thank you.
Nice. Yeah. Well, you're currently at Men as Peacemakers. We met at DAIP, Domestic Abuse Intervention Program, facilitating men's groups there.
Right. Yep.
And so now you're here. So talk about, we'll step back to that in a little bit. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about Men as Peacemakers and what you do and what is this organization?
Yeah, we get that question a lot because we have a storefront office on Superior Street. We get a fair amount of walk-in traffic. People see the sign and they come in and they say, what do you do? Or we go to various events. And I know people who have known of the organization for a while and still don't necessarily know what we do. And that's partially because we do a lot of different things. So Men as Peacemakers started quite a while ago, not as a direct response, but as part of an extended response to a string of domestic violence murders in Duluth. And a group of men led by Frank Jewell, who is now a St. Louis County Commissioner, and some other folks said, this men's violence against women thing is a problem that men need to play a role in solving. And they started meeting, and eventually they created the organization that's called Men as Peacemakers. The organization looks and functions much differently now from how it used to, but that core belief that boys and men have a role to play in ending violence against girls and women is still a really big deal, and it runs through every aspect of our programming. So one of the ways I describe what we do now, I say we are a multifaceted nonprofit organization that in everything we do is trying to create a new norm, a new normal in which no one uses violence against anyone. We know that's a big dream. We don't think we're going to do it tomorrow or in 10 years, but we're working toward it all the time. Most of how we try to do that is through a process called primary prevention, which involves working with kids as young as possible to help contradict some of the messages they get about what it means to be a boy, what it means to be a girl, what gender is, how gender can be expressed. We're like a lot of organizations that started in an attempt to address gender-based violence. We are not as evolved as we could be in being as inclusive as we would like to be. But we have staff members and community members who work with us who live trans lives and who are really good at helping educate people about trans issues. So when I talk about boys and men and girls and women, I understand that that's binary language. We are also doing everything we can to address violence, not just in those binary situations, but in all the complicated ways people see themselves and experience themselves and experience the rest of the world, because violence exists. You know, we exist in a culture that celebrates hierarchy, it celebrates dominance, and punishes noncompliance, and those dynamics exist in all kinds of relationships among all kinds of people. So I'm still not as good at talking about that stuff as I would like to be, and that's not meant to be an evasion or an excuse. It's just an acknowledgement that I'm still in process. My vocabulary and my knowledge are emerging. but I got away from my core description. We're trying to create a new normal where violence doesn't exist. We do that mostly through primary prevention. There are multiple groups of folks here who work in schools who are trying to educate people in ways that help them see and contradict the hierarchical norms around them. I work in a program called the Domestic Violence Restorative Circles. It is one of two programs here in which we respond to violence after it's happened. And we respond in a way that is intended to help repair harm to individuals and communities. So we're a nonprofit. We're trying to create a new norm that includes no violence, where everyone is free not just to survive but to thrive. Mm. We mostly try to do that through primary prevention, but we also work with people who have committed and experienced violence because we see that as another way of preventing more violence from happening.
Talk about the restorative circles. Like, mm-hmm. What does that look like a little bit?
Yeah, so the Domestic Violence Restorative Circles program, or the DVRC, actually includes two types of circles, transition circles and support circles. Transition circles are technically for anyone who is coming out of jail or prison, or who has, you know, in the last few months or year maybe been released from jail or prison for using violence against an intimate partner in a relationship. So that's where the transition comes from, helping them transition from the legal consequence for using violence, whether it's pre-sentence or post-incarceration, into a nonviolent life. And I can talk more about those in a moment. Support circles are for people who have survived the violence used by people who get into the transition circles. So we are not an organization that is set up to do just broad advocacy and survivor support. The advocacy and support we do, because of some details about how we're set up and our grant funding, has to be connected to working with survivors of the perpetrators we take into our program.
Okay.
In those descriptions, I was actually struggling pretty hard to use gender-neutral language. because technically speaking, you know, like I kind of clumsily said before, we know that intimate partner violence happens in partnerships of all different kinds. Mm-hmm. It is not just a cis-hetero relationship issue. The fact of how we operate is that every referral for a transition circle we get is for a cis hetero guy who has used violence against a cis hetero woman in a heterosexual single relationship.
Okay.
So all the transition circle participants we have are cis hetero men.
Okay.
All the survivor or support circle participants we have are cis hetero women. That might suggest that that's the only form of relationship violence that's happening in Duluth or in St. Louis County, and that's not true, but that's where we are. So we would definitely accept referrals of other folks, but we haven't yet.
And you just haven't gotten them.
Correct.
So you haven't even had the opportunity to accept them.
Correct. Correct. Yeah. So transition circles are for anyone, but in our experience, they mostly happen for men who have used violence against women in relationships, cis-hetero folks. We have a steering committee that helps feed referrals to us, and it's folks who work for advocacy, survivor advocacy organizations and criminal justice, folks who work in various parts of the criminal justice system who come into contact with people who have used violence in relationships. We get referrals from them. We screen the people they refer. If we decide that they're appropriate for the program, we set up a transition circle, and the circle is the participant, that person that was referred to us, and between 4 and 6 community volunteers who we have trained to participate in this process. It's intended to be a multi-month process that moves relatively gradually from a getting to know you phase, so all the people who are in the circle together get to know each other as human beings, eventually winds up in a phase where the participant needs to speak pretty openly and in a fair amount of detail about violence he has used and the harm it has caused. And not because we want to get him to say stuff out loud because we think that's accountability, not because we want to punish him or shame him, but because the ideal outcome of the process is that after looking clearly and honestly at the violence he has used, he comes up with a plan for how to repair harm where possible and live nonviolently in the future. And in order to do that, you just need to talk frankly about what has happened, because mm-hmm. you can't talk about how to repair harm as much as possible or how to do things differently if you don't talk about what you've done. That's something I know from my own experience, and I've just seen it be true for a lot of other people. So a participant and some community volunteers meet once a week for a few months, and they talk about that kind of stuff. And ideally, at the end, the guy's got a really clear set of what we call goals and agreements for how he's going to do things differently. They become part of his probation conditions. There's a specific Arrowhead Regional Corrections probation officer that works with guys who are in our program. Judge Sean Flerke gets all their cases. So there are a lot of people who are keeping an eye on the guy, not because they want to catch him doing something wrong again, but because they want to help him. They don't want him to use violence anymore. They want the women and kids in his life to be safe, and they want the community to be safer. And it's all about attempting, again, as much as possible to repair harm to individuals and communities. Support circles function in a lot less, they're not as structured. Anytime a guy gets accepted into the transition circle, we contact usually the person he most recently has used violence against and see if she would like us to support her in whatever way we can. It is not uncommon for us to not receive a response, or to receive a response that says, either in a friendly way or not so friendly way, no. Every now and then someone will say, yeah, that would be nice. I need help with this, or I need help with that. Again, we put together a circle of volunteers, and instead of going through an intended process, the intention is to see what that person needs or wants and be flexible and provide it.
So what might that type of support look like?
It might look like getting together and just chatting. It might look like saying, I don't know how to balance all the stuff I have to do right now because I have a bunch of social worker appointments and I'm trying to work, and my daycare fell through, and half my friends won't talk to me anymore because they think it's my fault that he got locked up. What can I do? And we don't know the answers to all those questions, and we can't wave a magic wand and fix anything. Mm-hmm. But part of what we can do is say, whew, that's a lot. Come see us anytime you need to. We can contact other agencies. We can give someone literally just a place to sit down and put their bags down and rest for a moment while we help refer them to other folks. So it really is a person by person. What we can do and how we do it is person by person. Sure. We are not set up to be a direct advocacy organization. We don't pretend to be one. We try to foster relationships with advocates at Safe Haven and other places. But we also try to do what we can.
What do you think is behind for the women or the people who have had violence used against them for turning you down for mm-hmm. assistance? What do you think is behind that?
Yeah, so I try to speak really carefully when I talk about this because mm-hmm. I have more secondhand knowledge about it than a lot of people have, but it's all secondhand knowledge. So everything I'm saying comes from talking to women who have survived violence. My understanding is that a lot of women who are either still in or have left relationships with men using violence against them are pretty acutely aware of when they can and can't accept help for a lot of different reasons, the most prominent of which is usually just the danger it could put them in. So I've talked to women who have said, you know, I went to a doctor's appointment and the nurse who was doing the intake saw a bruise and asked me about it. And I couldn't be honest with her. I lied to her and told her that I fell down the stairs or whatever. But it meant something to me that she asked. I now knew, like, there was the way that she asked suggested that if I told her the truth, she wouldn't freak out. She would know what to do. So I had that in my head then, that if I was in a place where I felt like I could ask for help, I could go to that person. I've talked to women who have said, I have been asked if I need help by people who I cursed out for asking. Hmm. And I can imagine what that looked like to them. And it was something I needed to do in the moment, because if it got back to the guy who was using violence against me, that I had agreed with what this person said about him, I knew what was going to happen to me. So it gets incredibly complicated, and it's really common for people who try to help women who are surviving violence to perceive and describe those women as non-compliant or resistant or unappreciative. Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, again, it's a person-by-person basis, but part of what it comes down to for me, based on what I've learned from advocates and from survivors, is that even if it's not a safety issue, it could just be a capacity issue. You know, I've talked to women who are like, I'm trying to figure out how to say this in the right way. Like, even if it's not a matter of safety, it might just be a matter of energy or emotion. I've talked to women who say, we talked to a survivor recently who said, it took me forever to come in and accept your offer for help, because if I accepted the offer, that made the violence real. Mm-hmm. In order to accept help, I have to look at it in a way that just about buries me. Some people don't want another advocate or do-gooder in their life. Some people are skeptical of our relatively close relationship with criminal justice. Some people think that we are on the team that's trying to get their husband or boyfriend locked up. There are a lot of different reasons. It's not for us to say whether they're legitimate or illegitimate. There are a lot of different reasons for people surviving violence to not accept offers of help. And we try to be really, really careful about saying, we're offering this help. This isn't your only chance to take it. We'll give it to you anytime you want to accept it.
That's cool.
It's not, you don't have to take it now. We are not going to, we're never going to be coy with you about what we think. We're also not going to tell you you have to leave your boyfriend or husband to take the help. We're not going to tell you what we think you should do. We'll be honest with you if we're scared for you. We'll be honest with you about what we see. But nothing that we do to help you is conditional on you following some kind of rule we set in terms of relationship status, because we know there are a lot of reasons why women stay in relationships with men who are using violence against them.
Mm-hmm. It's always interesting. It always comes up with the whole, well, if you're in an abusive relationship, just get out.
Right.
You know, I hear that all the time. And I was just listening to something where they were talking about how hard it is to get out of a relationship that isn't great,
yep,
but isn't necessarily violent, or isn't, you know what I mean, isn't abusive. It's just you're in this relationship and it's not great. And you want to get out because you know it's time to get out, and how hard it is to do that.
Yes.
And then add violence. And I get how that statement could make sense, but I also want to have something to say to bridge that gap, because there is no part of me, it's just never that easy.
It's not.
It's never that easy.
And it's never for anyone who's not living the experience to decide what the response to the experience should be. And again, we're not coy or falsely passive about it, right? Mm-hmm. Like I'm thinking of multiple conversations I've had with multiple people over the years where, you know, I wish I could leave. I just can't. I love him, or, you know, it's going to be hard for the kids, or people are going to judge me, or whatever. And I would never say, well, you should do it anyway. You know, it's irresponsible of you to, but I will say, I feel like you've said that before. You know, first of all, I support you, whatever you do, but I feel like you've said that before. I feel like you're struggling with, like, part of you, when I hear what you say, it sounds to me like part of you really wants to leave. Part of you doesn't want to have to leave. Like, it's different on a person-to-person basis, mm-hmm. but never, I just don't feel like it's my job and my coworkers here. You know, I've never been a direct advocate. I have coworkers here who have been. And I learn a lot from them, and we have a lot of conversations about this kind of stuff, and we all see it kind of the same way. If we're afraid for them, we'll be honest. If it seems like they need help identifying possibilities, we'll be honest. But it's not our job or our right to say, you have to leave him, or you should leave him, or you're foolish if you don't leave him. Being battered, being emotionally and physically abused over a long amount of time messes up a person's head. And that's not to say that this thing called battered women syndrome is a thing. It's to say that survival mode is survival mode, and sometimes this sounds messed up, but sometimes for someone who's living in with violence, uncomfortable situation or a dangerous situation they understand can be or feel safer than the mystery of something else. And we haven't even started talking about post-separation violence, which is a very real thing. You know, there's, like you said, there's this myth that when you leave the person who's using violence against you directly and physically, you're not going to be in danger anymore and your life is going to improve and become less complicated. And that's just not true for a lot of different reasons. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there are a lot of myths that are comfortable to believe about especially men's violence against women, and they almost all somehow come back around and put the responsibility on women for ending violence against them. So I just went on a long ramble there. There are a lot of reasons why women decide to stay. A lot of times my gut response to those decisions is that doesn't make any sense. And then I start thinking, okay, what is it that I don't know about that situation that could lead someone to make that decision? And usually it is, I'm not saying it's easily understandable. I'm not saying it's the most logical thing. I'm saying whatever it is, it's that person's decision. And to truly support that person who's already being controlled is you don't control them more. You don't put conditions on them. You say you want to help them, and then you make sure you are being consistent and compassionate with that.
Well, and it sounds like you're then sort of opening the door to that conversation where if a person says, I want to leave, but I feel like I can't because mm-hmm. of these reasons, it allows that conversation of what are those barriers yep. and can you help them over, you know, or give them some guidance, direction to how to solve that barrier? Because yes. I can imagine that there are situations where it is the whole, you want to leave, but you feel like you can't. But if you had somebody who could support you or help you think through that, then maybe you can solve those problems. But on your own, they feel insurmountable. You feel judged. All of those things. Mm-hmm. And when you have that support and that guidance and maybe just another solution that you didn't know existed,
right.
sometimes it helps you get over the hump.
Right. And sometimes, I mean, I do believe that if a particular problem needs to be and can be solved, that's a huge part. But part of what you just said is important. A huge tactic of men's violence against women can be isolation. And isolation can look like a lot of things other than locking someone in a room. It can definitely include that, but it could also be, you know, there are people walking around out and about in public who are incredibly isolated because they know what the consequences will be if they seek support. And sometimes just having a single person who's not going to judge, who's not going to instruct, who's just going to listen and be present can be incredibly empowering. I know this from my own life, and in the context of domestic violence, I've been fortunate to hear women speak about their experiences and say that. I'm not saying I know what it's like to be a woman who's been battered. When it does get to a point where someone says, you know, I need this money for food, or I need gas money, or I don't know how to file an order for protection, that's where sometimes we can help directly with that. And if we can't, if we don't have that expertise that advocates who are working, legal advocates or safety advocates or other people who are working day to day in that, that's where we very quickly, you know, we say, is it okay if we contact so-and-so at Safe Haven? Can we walk you up there? Can we have them come down here? This is a logistic or an institutional or an organizational thing that can be solved. We don't know how to do it. So it's just being there in general. And then, you know, when concrete solvable issues do come up, doing everything we can to help.
Talk a little bit about how long have you been working and connected to domestic violence?
I think probably about 2007 or 2008. I was a technically an adjunct instructor, but I was teaching full-time at St. Scholastica and became involved in some on-campus efforts to change campus culture to, you know, again, create a new norm where relationship and sexual violence just were not supported in any way, where, you know, it just would be impossible to use those forms of violence. And that's a big goal, but that's what we were trying to do. I wound up sitting in a lot of meetings. Didn't really feel like I was doing anything direct or real. Just felt like teaching work. And I was learning a lot, and I was grateful to be around like-minded people who are having the same conversations. I met a guy named Ed Heisler, who was at that time working for Safe Haven Shelter for battered women. And one day expressed to him my frustration with just sitting in meetings. And he said, well, I do this work at the Domestic Abuse Intervention Program. I co-facilitate critical dialogue among men who batter. He didn't say it exactly like that. That's how I say it. And I'm writing this flashback scene in this movie. He said, I think you'd be good at that, and I think you'd like it. And I did the training. And in summer 2010, I started co-facilitating groups. And then, as you know, stepped away from that in December of 2018 because I was getting burnt out on it. I didn't feel like I was doing a very good job. And it's not good to go into those conversations feeling slightly hopeless. You know, I'm never going to be a ray of sunshine, but I acknowledged to myself that I was feeling angry a lot. I was feeling combative. I was, you know, even on my good nights, I didn't feel like I was doing that good of a job. And I tend to be hard on myself, but I also think there was something to that. But the quick answer to your question is 2008 started building a vocabulary and being involved, and in 2010 started working directly with men who abuse violence, and have just kept trying to learn more and more since then.
So let's talk about the men's groups a little bit, because I do think you were being hard on yourself. You were doing a great job, I think, because you and I co-facilitated mm-hmm. together for a while until mm-hmm. you left. And I appreciate all that you brought me into that fold. It was a great experience. And I love doing the work. So describe the men's groups and what the purpose is for them.
Yeah, so as you know, those groups are part of a program that is run according to a curriculum that's called Creating a Process of Change for Men Who Batter. And that's what that group process is intended to do, is to help men who have used long-term physical and emotional violence against women start a process of change that leads them away from that behavior and the thinking that supports that behavior. If those groups are to be as effective as possible, they need to be part of a multi-agency, multi-layer response to that violence. In a community that is operating according to the Duluth model philosophy, that response is called a coordinated community response. So ideally, the group is just one component in a really broad, multi-layered response to violence that is based in perceiving men's violence against women as a community health issue, not as an issue of individual pathology or, you know, one man gone wrong or something. So basically saying, this is a community problem. It's the community's job to respond to it. And we definitely need to have ways of protecting people who are experiencing violence from the people who are using the violence. I'm not a huge fan of incarceration. I believe it's necessary when it's obvious that locking someone up is going to prevent them from hurting someone they would otherwise hurt. But if we're serious about solving the problem, we also need to help people do things differently and see things differently. And that's what these groups are about. So once a week, two co-facilitators and a group of men, usually court-ordered, to be there, get together, and the facilitators truly facilitate. They're not teaching lessons. They're not telling people what to do. They're leading conversation that's intended to build productive self-awareness among the guys in the group. And ideally, that self-awareness leads them to not only acknowledge what they have done wrong, but develop some deep consciousness about the thinking and the beliefs that lead to violence being an option. We're not trying to create feminists We're not trying to get people to think exactly the way we think. We want them to stop using violence. And our experience tells us that in order to do that, they need to know not like the deep, we're not trying to do therapy. We're not trying to heal all the wounds, although there are a lot of guys who are wounded. We're trying to help them see the thinking that supports using the violence. And that's a difficult thing. That's difficult for people who aren't in those groups. It took me a long time to figure out why I was emotionally abusive in a lot of my relationships. It's really hard for a lot of these guys to do that, but that's what we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. We're not trying to fix them. We're not trying to tell them how to think. We're not trying to indoctrinate them. We really are trying to give them an opportunity to be more of the man most of them actually want to be, but have never had the opportunity to sit down and figure out how to be. Mm-hmm. Using a group process to help individuals.
And different topics that we bring out.
Yes.
To discuss, to start conversations that lead to the self-discovery.
Yes.
For the guys.
Yeah.
And it's a fascinating thing to watch.
Mm-hmm.
It's a 27 week.
Yep.
That they have 27 weeks. And like you said, most of them are court ordered. There are some who voluntarily come before they're told to, and there are some who come after they have completed the program. And it is a fascinating journey to see somebody from day one to week 27.
Yeah. You know? Whether they have not changed at all or whether they've changed significantly. Mm-hmm. I get both of those things are, of course, I prefer one over the other, but I can't say it's not fascinating to see a guy go through 6 months of intense conversation and come out the other end and say, yep, I was right. That was a waste of my time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it breaks my heart. It frustrates me. I feel all kinds of ways about that, but it's fascinating.
Right.
Be impervious.
Right. And it's. I am so grateful that that's not the most common response.
Same.
You know, because that would make it really, really hard to be there each week and to do this work and have these conversations.
Yes.
But it is absolutely amazing when the guys can sit there and describe to you how they're thinking differently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. This is why I did the X. This is what I was thinking.
Yep.
This is why that thinking was wrong. And it's not the language we have used.
Correct.
When it comes out of their mouth and the way they think in their words, it is so exciting.
Yeah. When they just say our words back to us, the way a student might when they're trying to get
an A.
positive attention from a teacher, I don't trust it at all.
Right.
And to be honest, I every now and then when I was facilitating would let myself have, two or three seconds of feeling satisfied or feeling hopeful if a guy said something that seemed to suggest his thinking was changing.
Mm-hmm.
I would let myself think, well, that's cool. That's neat. But I also just had a lot of experiences where guys picked up some vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
And, a lot of guys who batter are incredibly engaging and are very smart and are really good at playing a role. And, it makes sense for someone who has lived their life like that in the situation that we've got them in to pick up on what we obviously want from them, pick up on our vocabulary, and start giving that to us.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they realize that we can't do anything with that, right? We're just going to keep asking them to look at themselves and think about their thinking. But so I try to be cautiously optimistic, mm-hmm. but also incredibly measured in my response,
mm-hmm.
because I have had experiences where a guy who really seems like an all-star in group reoffends. I've also had experiences where a guy who's just a pain in the ass the whole time is actually changing and is maintaining that front within the group, because regardless of what else is changing, he's not going to be a guy who in that situation is like, hey, you're really helping me see some things and I'm developing some insights. And, he's not going
to talk
about it that way.
They have a facade to keep up in that space.
Yeah. So he's still going to be tough or quiet or whatever else. But And then, you know, there's all kinds of contradictions between how guys present to us and what they're like in their relationships and in the rest of the world. So
that's the frustrating part of all of that.
Yeah, I learned very quickly to not make any assumptions about the connection between what we see and what other people see. And sometimes that means I am not giving a guy credit, but very often it means having a wise boundary up in terms of perception.
Right. Like you say, for some of the guys who know exactly what to say because they've had to work in the world as a person who uses domestic violence and hides it, you have to figure out how to work in your culture just as the woman does to protect herself.
Yes.
You know, so she has her things that she learns. He has his things that he learns.
Yep.
And then when I think of the men who are in our group, because there's a lot of assumptions, you know, when I talk to people about this work or these guys, there's a lot of assumptions about these men, right? And why they're in group. And I always remain just as concerned, maybe sometimes more so, about the guys who are out there.
Yes.
Who are never going to be in these groups.
Yes.
Because they're always going to be able to not get caught.
Yep.
Or manipulate the situation or whatever. They're never going to be in that space. And, you know, we know of them who actively are in our town doing big things and knowing they will never be in our group. But they're the people who need to be here sometimes more than anything else. And so there's that interesting division that I kind of try to caution people towards or discuss whenever it's like these guys, you know, kind of who they are and where they come from and what they've experienced. Like, no, they got caught.
Yeah.
You know, they got caught. There's a lot of people running around who are never, ever, ever going to get caught. And I know I have talked to the guys in group about this of just in a sense that they are... I don't like to use the word lucky. There has to be a better word. But that they are here and doing the work and have this opportunity to have these conversations, which some of the guys articulate themselves as saying, this is the only place I get to talk about this stuff.
Yep.
I don't get to talk about this stuff because I can't talk about this stuff with other people, or they don't understand it, or they see it as too fluffy. Or if I go to talk to the guys at the bar and talk about, I want other men's feedback. All they do is villainize my partner instead of having a conversation about what's really going on.
Yep.
And that is where I think sometimes is such a great thing that that exists.
Yep.
You know, and I wish more people, perhaps us all, could be a part of that conversation.
Yeah, I've got a friend, person I knew in the past who's a big proponent of Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous. I was talking to her once and said, you know, I'm not a 12-stepper, but I envy what she and I knew each other well enough that I could say this, and she knew where I was coming from with it, you know, that I was conscious of the privilege it was coming from. I said, I envy people in 12-step groups because it's a place where you don't have to, there's no pretense. You don't have to pretend anything. You just talk about yourself exactly who you are. And she said among the 12-step groups I've been a part of, there's a saying that everybody needs a group. And we mean addicts and normies and everybody. You know, even if you don't consider yourself an alcoholic or an addict, you've got something. And it can be helpful for anyone to sit in a place where you get to give an unvarnished view of yourself. Just be completely authentic, have people call you on your BS while showing you love at the same time, and, you know, just work the steps. And it makes a lot of sense to me. So what you said about the fact that a lot of people could benefit from the type of critical dialogue that we're doing, I 100% agree with that. And I share your, you know, it's really easy for people who... What I usually tell people is that what they think about guys who show up in the groups and how the groups work is part of it is exactly what they think it is. And most of it is absolutely nothing close to what they would think.
Mm-hmm.
And when I, you know, they can sort of wrap their heads around that. But then when I say, I don't know, I know maybe three men in my life who couldn't go into one of those groups and within two or three sessions be part of the conversation.
Mm.
And I don't mean to minimize certain types of abuse and say every man is abusive. So I don't want to generalize. I don't want to minimize. But my understanding of how the world works is that a lot of men have been so effectively conditioned to expect women's deference that we don't realize when we are enforcing it. And to be in a situation where you're asked to think directly about that is really interesting. And in my experience, part of how you gauge a person's consciousness of that, thought process on it, is to pay attention to how vigorously they fight against the existence of the concept. Mm-hmm. And it's one thing to say, huh, I never thought about that. It's another thing to say, absolutely not. That doesn't exist. I don't participate in that. I resent you saying so. Well, that's an interesting response. Right? Let's talk about that. That got off into the weeds a little bit. And I've heard a lot of guys, you know, on their last night say, I started off thinking this was pointless. I didn't think I needed to be here. And now I can think of 10 or 15 guys I know who I wish could do this because it would be helpful for them and the people in their lives. You know, and again, they're not guys who are like, they're not going to run out and buy a "this is what a feminist looks like" T-shirt.
Right.
They're not going to join a feminist book club, but the way they see themselves and the women in their lives is different, mm-hmm. and is emerging and transforming, and they see things differently.
Right. Yeah. And those steps can look very different. I mean, they look very different for each person.
Yes.
But like you say, yeah, it's not that everybody's going to walk out and read Eat, Pray, Love and be all into it.
Right.
But when somebody can sit there and say, well, I've been through this group 3 times and I finally understand empathy and how I haven't had it, yeah. and how I'm starting to have it. And this is how I'm responding differently to this person in my life. And this is how this is changing.
Yes.
And this is how this is helping me understand it. That's huge.
It's a huge deal. I think it's also important to acknowledge that, you know, those patriarchal norms we're talking about endanger men as much as they endanger women. And I'm not trying to create a false equivalency. I'm not saying that the forms of danger or the degrees of danger are the same. But I can speak from experience about what it's like to lose social support and lose friends and have some scary stuff happened because I decided to really vigorously contradict those norms and call out friends who were using violence. And I didn't see that until I read a paper at a conference that has to do with some experiences I've had doing this work. And it includes some really vigorous descriptions of what happened when I tried to help a friend who had been arrested for using violence against a woman, a guy that I would have called a friend. And that's a whole complicated thing. But I got done, and she said, I never stopped to think how violating those social norms can be dangerous for people who benefit from them mm-hmm. in different ways, but in significant ways. Like, you know, people who are always vulnerable to them are always vulnerable to them. But if you benefit from them and not only try to, you can't ever give those benefits away, but if you try to name them, if you try to destabilize the system and destabilize the people who benefit from them, it can snap back on you. Like, you can be in danger too. Mm-hmm. So part of what we're asking these guys to do is to not only see the presence of those things in their own lives, but destabilize themselves. And if they get to a point to destabilize how the system benefits other people in their lives, that's a really, really hard thing. It's something that needs to be done, but I also think it's worthwhile and important to say, you know, asking anyone to violate dominant social norms is a big ask. I think I get tongue-tied trying to talk about it because I don't want to say, oh, it's the same for everybody. I don't believe that. But I know what it's like to, like I said, to put myself in a vulnerable social and safety and professional spot by naming things that benefit me and people around me. That mm-hmm. usually does not get responded to with patience and kindness.
Well, and that's what men are being asked to do, right? Like when we look at how do men support or how can men support these changes out in their world on an everyday mm-hmm. level? And mm-hmm. one of those things is asking men when you see somebody say something mm-hmm. sexist or violent or whatever to call them on it.
Yeah.
Do you have any like help with that? Because I think that is something that, you know, that is really, it is a really hard thing to do.
Yeah.
And how can one do that? You know, I know as a white female, there are times when I want to call a male.
Yep.
And I know for me being female, it's also different than a male, right? Yes. And that's why us women want men to do it, because when men do it, it's very differently effective than if I do it, because then I'm just being a soft-hearted, annoying feminist.
Yeah, and that's one of the false equivalencies I don't want to make. Like, Shannon, my wife, has a plan for what she's going to do when she gets attacked. She's never been attacked. But her plan, I want to make this really clear, her plan isn't for what she's going to do if she gets attacked. She's just assuming it's going to happen sometime. The first time she told me that, it blew my mind. And I thought, wow, you're kind of overreacting, aren't you? Like, she's kind of a bold, aggressive, you know, she's a Leo. She carries herself like a Leo. And she was like, no, Chris, this, I understand what you're saying, but this isn't me. Like, I've made it a habit to ask women I know, like, is this something you think about? The women I ask about it don't all talk about it in the same way Shannon does. But they are all conscious of what can happen. Mm-hmm. And that connects to a tweet I saw the other day. This is going to sound weird, but it was a really funny way of a woman basically saying, I know that if a guy catcalls me and I flip him off, I can be in danger. So I have never felt like I could possibly die because I contradict the gender norms I'm supposed to uphold and perform. Mm-hmm. I can tell you for sure that, especially as a younger man, I avoided contradicting things because I thought I was going to get beat up. That's still not the same. That's still not the same as, like, getting beat up is one thing, especially if it's by a person who's, you know, like, I'm usually bigger than most other people in a room. So I'm getting kind of off into the weeds again here, but there is danger in violating social norms. The levels and types of danger are different based on where people sit in those hierarchies. So I don't mean to say that, yeah, it's the same for me as it is for you. It exists, but I've never been afraid that a guy might kill me because I undermine his sense of masculinity. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of women who are very, very careful mm-hmm. in how they speak to men, especially men they don't know, mm-hmm. because they have to be. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that all men are bad. Doesn't mean that all men are evil or violent. It means there is enough of an established pattern of men punishing women for undermining men's masculinity that's a daily part of pretty much every woman's life, is being conscious of the men around them and picking up on cues whether or not they're conscious of doing that. And that gets really complicated in a lot of ways, especially when we put skin color and culture into it, you know, because different women, you know, there's all kinds of layers of this stuff. Intersectionality is a thing. Mm-hmm. So I can't remember exactly where we started.
Is there anything you can give men?
Anything to give? Yeah, I don't feel qualified to do that. I will. But I don't feel qualified to, because I've let myself down and I've let women down so many times in my life. Part of what perpetuates a lot of this stuff is just basic social awkwardness. Mm-hmm. It's really awkward to be on an airplane or at a party or in a conversation among friends and hear someone say some sexist, misogynistic thing and be the person that says, that sucked. I mean, it's weird to say. I know people who don't think twice about it, and they will say that, and they won't care whether someone's going to get uncomfortable. They won't care if the situation is just irreparably broken. Most people I know have been raised to be, you know, polite and not trying to make a fuss. And so it takes a fair amount to say, something. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's productive to say, you're a sexist. You're a misogynist.
Right.
I understand how people get there. I don't know what a sexist or a misogynist is. I know what sexist and misogynist language look like. So part of what I try to do is not label the person, but label the behavior, label the thing. I also try, not because I'm trying to protect the person I'm talking to or talking about, but because I'm trying to be precise, because I think precision is a big deal here. I try to say what it was I heard and how I interpret it and other people might interpret it. So like if a friend of mine, you know, said something, I might say, hey, so this is going to make me a pain in the ass, but that thing you just said could come across this way. And I don't know if you meant it to, you know, and again, this all, it depends on your relationship right. with the person. It depends on the setting. It depends on a whole bunch of different stuff. I think sometimes it's a legit thing to say, shut up. We don't do that here. I'm not opposed to shutting someone down and just saying, if you want to talk like that, leave, take it somewhere else. That's not sustainable for building and maintaining a relationship right. with someone.
Right.
And sometimes that's not the most important thing, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's standing up for someone who is in a vulnerable position or shouldn't have to defend themselves when there are people who are better positioned to do it in the moment. And again, all this stuff I'm talking about, I have mostly learned by doing the wrong thing over and over again. This is probably an unattractive thing to admit, but a huge reason why I do the work I do is I have regrets I am never going to be able to resolve, because I have mistreated people, and I have colluded with the mistreatment of people, and I've been a coward, and I can't make up for that stuff. And it's not the only reason, but it's a reason, right? It's there. So I'm not saying I've done these things perfectly all the time, but I'm getting, you know, at close to 50, I'm finally getting to a place where I feel comfortable creating discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
Feel comfortable being the person who takes on the awkwardness. And I don't always know how to do it. Like, I'm very conscious. Like, I don't want to try to be a guy who protects women because I think they can't protect themselves. Right. Mm-hmm. But I also think it's important to be like in a mixed setting or in a all male setting to be the guy who says that thing was messed up. Like, there's a way to just name it.
Mm-hmm.
And a huge part of that for me is not expecting that anything is going to happen. That I'm not going to change anyone's mind. I'm not going to convince somebody. I'm not going to say the wise, perfect thing that gets people to say, wow, Chris, you've helped me really see some important things today. Okay, so but to get back to it, to name it, mm-hmm. hey, when you said this, I don't know what you were intending to mean, but I interpreted it this way, and you might not know how that can be hurtful to some people. And then, you know, I've done that once or twice and had people say, I really didn't know that, and I feel bad about it, and I thank you for letting me know.
Mm-hmm.
I've also had people say, oh, hey, what's up, Mr. Buzzkill? We can't make jokes anymore.
Right.
Right? And then, you know, so another layer of it is having a next move planned.
Right.
Because I'm not a clever person. I know people who are really good at, like, verbal sparring. One of the reasons I try to rely on precision and just naming things clearly is I can put words together fairly well sometimes. I am not a good or a clever strategic thinker. So I can't get into a debate with someone and, like, make them submit with all kinds of mental judo moves. I get too uncomfortable and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So say something. Try to say it as clearly as possible. Try not to label the person. And all of this is something I've learned from my boss here, Sarah. Don't expend a ton of energy getting into a back and forth with the person. It's okay at some point to say, listen, it seems like we see this differently, and I'm gonna leave. But no, I don't have a formula for... when you see your buddy being an asshole, here's exactly what you do, because that's always a difficult situation.
Right.
You know, Albus Dumbledore said it's more difficult to stand up to your friends than it is to stand up to your enemies.
Right.
And that is true for me, because there's a relationship and there's investment and there's community. I also think that's one of the reasons why it's important. But I don't I don't have a formula. I've got a lot more to say on it, but I've already gone on too long.
Well, but I think that's a really good start, because I think it's sometimes having those things sort of thought out a little bit in your head before they come up, because when they come up, they catch you off guard. I was just in a situation a little while back, and I sat there going, I have no idea what to do with this right now, you know, and was sort of like hoping somebody else would step in because it would give me a moment to support them, but really needing somebody else to take the to take the lead. And so, and I think sometimes if men can do that in a place where other men see it, it allows the women to feel safer.
Yeah.
Or sometimes it lets you know how safe you are not.
Yeah.
As well, when we see somebody try to reasonably stand up to somebody about something they said or just call them on it, and that other person gets super angry, it's kind of lets you as a woman know, okay, that's where you're at. All right, good for me to know.
Yeah.
And then sometimes makes it, of course, harder for the woman to come in and agree, or sometimes can be that support that that man stepping out lets them know, okay, we're not alone in the room here.
Right.
And then you can have that conversation. And I can imagine that, you know, that can go well and not well. But but sometimes it is that planting the seed and opening the door that gets that person, maybe not in that moment, but at some point to kind of rethink what they're thinking a little bit.
I've seen situations where there's just great power in naming it.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, that was a really offensive thing you said. And offensive isn't my favorite term. I'm not... You know, I have offended people by sticking, you know, like I've got uncles who are offended by me saying racism exists, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
So I understand why a lot of people use it. I try not to use it because I think it's an easy thing to dismiss. Say, that was a super offensive thing you said. It's one of the reasons I try to be precise. Hey, you just made a joke that's at the expense of a person's sexuality. You're basically saying that they're expressing themselves that way or whatever is a joke, and that just seems really wrong and mean and cruel. And sometimes just saying that breaks something, and it doesn't fix anything, it doesn't solve anything, it doesn't resolve anything, but it shows that it exists.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't pretend that it doesn't exist. I've seen a lot of people get in really unproductive kind of tussles when they think, oh, if I say this thing, here's how this person is going to respond. They're going to feel bad, or they're going to feel ashamed, and then they're going to apologize. But that doesn't happen, because a lot of people who say those kinds of things don't care what other people think.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily that, you know, and this is something I had to learn really hard ways. It's not about demolishing the person. It's not about making that person look or feel stupid. It's not about getting them to admit they were wrong. It's about expressing solidarity with the people who are being hurt by it. And there are a lot of different ways to do that. And but to go into it, there's this well-intentioned arrogance of if I barge in here and I say something, I'm going to look good and I'm going to fix it for other people and I'm going to get that person to feel bad and whatever. And I understand that impulse very clearly, but I also think that that's misdirected. It's not the most productive way of going about things, even if it might feel like the most satisfying way of going about it in the moment. Like, that person did something hurtful, I want to hurt them back. Instead of, that person did something hurtful, I want to let them know that at least one person here sees that it was hurtful. Not because I want to get kudos from the people I'm supposedly protecting, but because I, as a human being, don't want to tolerate that. And part of me not tolerating it is just saying, here's what happened, here's how I see it. And sometimes that's super lonesome.
Mm-hmm.
That's super scary. It's nothing else. It's just awkward.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would almost rather feel scared than awkward. You know, it shows some of my privilege, but oh God, I can just feel my heart racing when I think about what it's taken sometimes for me to, in just a, what is an otherwise pleasant family or social situation, to be the person who says, yep, I'm going to be the person who goes here and say, and again, it's not something I've done as often as I want to, but anyway, yeah. I said I wasn't going to say any more, and here I go. Blah, blah, blah,
well,
blah, blah.
And thank goodness for people being willing to stick their nose out, because it helps other people do the same thing and find that courage, and sometimes find the words, you know, or think about, well, that's how that went, and maybe that didn't go well, but you can still examine it didn't go well, but it still needs to be done.
Yes.
You know?
Yep. And that's it. Part of what prevents me from speaking up sometimes is thinking, I'm not going to say it right, and they're not going to take it seriously, and I might not be able to respond if they give this particular comeback or something, and like my ego gets caught up in it, and I am really, really grateful for having had experiences where I see other people do things I wish I had had the courage to do, and be like, that it can be done that way. And I want to be more like that person than the passive, frightened person, because that passivity and fear works to keep me comfortable at the expense of other people.
A couple more questions or thoughts I have on my mind. Yeah. One of them is, I know that you have been in domestic violence, you know, working with this for a good period of time, but is that something that you see as getting worse, getting better, changing?
Yeah, so I don't pay a lot of attention to statistics about rates of offenses and stuff. I think those types of information and data are one important component of telling the whole story. Numbers confuse me, to be honest, and I also think they can be used to dehumanize issues and obscure the real, like, literal flesh and blood stories. So I'm grateful there are people who do that kind of research, keep track of rates of offenses and reports and whatnot. My lived experience is that in some ways, domestic violence and men's violence against women especially are more parts of mainstream conversation than they have been. Mm-hmm. I also believe that increased visibility and presence in popular discourse does not reflect a reduction in the actual problem. It's not a super hopeful thing to say.
Right.
So it's a weird thing. Like, you know, you'd think, oh, there's Me Too, and you know, there are prominent men who have lost positions because they've been caught doing things they'd been doing for years and years, and this is a really great moment. And I think all that stuff is important. Mm-hmm. I also think there's a backlash to it.
Mm-hmm.
I know the men's rights movement. You know, I've got friends who say, it's just a few people with a social media platform. Don't fool yourself into thinking that's a really prominent movement. Well, but those men's rights outlets say things that I know a lot of mainstream people say and believe. So my perspective is that men's violence against women is a natural result of social norms that teach everyone to take boys and men more seriously than we take girls and women.
Mm-hmm.
If you're taught to take someone less seriously than yourself and they assert their seriousness, you might feel some ways about that. Right. And I think that manifests in a lot, you know, it manifests sometimes in men killing women. It also manifests a lot in daily life by men having no idea how much women are adjusting based on those expectations. I went home one day, like 2 years into doing this work, and said to Shannon, "Have you ever noticed that some men just don't take women very seriously?" And her face, like in half a second, her face registered gratitude, rage, disgust, like, and a whole bunch of other things. Because, you know, she told me later, she was like, "I was so happy to hear you say that out loud, and just so pissed off that it had taken you so long to see it." You know? So I asked her that, and her response was, yes, I've noticed that. You know? And I thought I was really identifying something. Like, right. Hey, wow. Hey, have you ever seen this? And she was like, you know, she was like 35 at the time. Yeah. I started seeing that when I was like sick. You know, that has been part of my daily life ever since. And it's very cute that you were almost 40 when you noticed it. I believe those social norms that lead to stuff like that, to even very well-intentioned men who are very curious about this stuff and are trying to do a lot of self-investigation. Like, it took me a long time to identify that. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people young men, older men, women, I say that to, and they're like, boy, Chris, your head is really deeply into this stuff. I think you're just like, you've kind of gone around the bend. You're just making stuff up. Those types of things don't exist. My experience tells me that all that is still, it's the bones in our bodies. It's mm-hmm. the air we breathe. It's the, if we were fish, it would be the water we swim in. And as long as that is part of our standard operating principle, the problem of men's violence is going to exist. So it is possible that I would look at like Department of Justice statistics about domestic violence reporting in a certain period and see that, oh, it's gone down 2.5% in, you know, this whatever period. Again, I think there's value in stuff like that. I think it's part of the story. And the stats classes I had in my doc program tell me that even people who do very careful statistical analysis are only looking at a tiny, 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 tiny little sliver mm-hmm. of the thing. I will also admit there's a lot about stats analysis I don't know, so it's possible someone could, you know, very easily point to where I'm wrong.
Well, it doesn't take into account for how things have shifted, in the sense that, because I'm with you, stats are a thing. They're a nice guidepost, but yeah. they are not the whole story.
Right.
And there's a lot of that story that statistics just cannot tell, right? Right. There's a lot of things that are never going to be in those statistics,
yes.
because we don't consider. I probably have mentioned the story on the podcast too, but the thing that always sticks in my mind is Tiger Woods. And I remember there was a news story, you know, we have Tiger Woods who cheats on his wife, blah, 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 all the story, humiliates her. And then, and I don't even know if this is true. I just know it was a news story at the time. And she had hit him with one of his golf clubs.
Yeah.
And people were like, oh my God. You know, I had a direct conversation with, that's horrible that she did that. That's violent. Look at what she is doing to this man. She is, you know, she's being violent. And I'm like, okay, not saying what she did is right. But hello, what, you know, she is
yeah.
the humiliation and all of that got just discounted. And somebody made the comment that, nope, wasn't right what she did. But was that not even in her conscious mind? It was that, in a sense, that's the thing he can understand.
Mm.
I don't know if that's a good way to look at it or not, but I thought it was an interesting perspective. So we focus on that violent act, right? The mm-hmm. violent act that she did gets a statistic count. His
right.
does not.
Right.
And so the statistics miss so much detail.
Yeah.
And we know the language. We talk about this more, so there's a lot more people who know mm-hmm. what to say in the room of mixed company versus the not room of mixed company.
Yeah.
Or the, you know. So yeah. it's not the thinking, but maybe it's some of the actions that have changed, but it's the underlying mm-hmm. stuff that still sits there mm-hmm. and drives those actions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So even if yeah. the statistics have changed or gotten better,
right.
it doesn't speak to the whole picture.
Yeah, and they don't, you know, if your statistics are about, you know, domestic violence reports or arrests, those are only stats about what's been reported and who's mm-hmm. been arrested. And, you know, I've said this to people before. Most of these types of violence, people don't get arrested for.
Mm-hmm.
They aren't reported. Well, what's your proof for that? Well, I don't have the type of proof you're looking for. Right. So if you require this particular type of proof, I'm not withholding it. I don't have it.
Right.
I know my lived experience, and I know what I've learned from survivors, and I know how this work has helped me see things I didn't used to see. And I also just have particular interpretations and beliefs about things that lead me to believe there is a certain form of men's control of women that is still very accepted and very expected.
Mm-hmm.
And along with that comes an expectation that women who defy control are deserving of certain consequences, and men who can't control women aren't full men, you know, and that things go pretty obvious places from there. Mm-hmm. There was a time when I would not have seen things that way. I always try to be really careful. I haven't yet said it, and that surprises me. I try to be careful in saying that my perspective is constantly evolving. A lot of the things I believe now, I didn't used to believe. Some of those beliefs have stayed, you know, after changing, have stayed very constant, despite how I've tried to challenge them. I try not to, you know, we all try to kind of confirm our own beliefs. Mm-hmm. Right? It's really gratifying to do that. I try to question mine a lot. Probably don't do it as rigorously as I think I do. But experience tells me that one of the like really subtle but kind of obvious social dynamics that perpetuates the stuff that leads to this violence is that people don't change their perspective after they get new information. Mm-hmm. And I try to make sure my perspective is always evolving. And I change it when I need to, but there's some things that have just remained really, really consistent. And they're things that I think are most credible.
It's always interesting when somebody says, oh, you know, male privilege, it's not as big as we think it is, and there's female privilege and all of this stuff. And then, you know, you see the whole statement of you'll watch the news or whatever, and we see that the women in politics are getting in trouble because they're too emotional.
Right.
And the men can do something that's more over the top, and but that's okay. Mm-hmm. And women will defend that. You know, so sometimes it's hard, again, it's hard as women to bring these things out in the mm-hmm. open and say, no, these things are not, this isn't cool, you know,
yep.
And certainly have the conversations that say, well, we're trying to demasculate men, mm-hmm. Which I understand the conversation on some levels and I don't on others. And it's probably because of the place that I sit with the work that I do as mm-hmm. well. Mm-hmm. So I can sort of see both sides of that. And I don't know how to respond to that incredibly yeah. well.
On a gut level, I don't take it very seriously. But then I think that's really dismissive. You know, I don't want to, just because I think it's kind of a ridiculous notion doesn't mean the people who think it are ridiculous or that it makes sense to, you know, to have the response be, well, that's dumb, mm-hmm. right? I don't believe, like, I present as fairly masculine. None of the way I conceive of myself as a man has been damaged by trying to learn how to be more kind and respectful to women. I don't buy this notion that in order to be a super typically masculine man, either in physical appearance or in behavior or like think of whatever masculine stereotype you want, you can do all that stuff and none of it has to revolve around or include hurting other people or treating yourself more importantly than other people, you know, women included. Maybe women prominently for this conversation. It just doesn't scan with me. So my perspective is that when I hear a man say, well, you know, there's this phrase, the pussification of America. Mm-hmm. You know, women are women and men are men, and the feminists and the Democrats just want us all to be equal. I don't know any feminist, even the most radical ones, who want to make men and women the same. That's a straw man argument, straw person argument. I know a lot of people, whether they refer to themselves as feminists or not, and I think it's fine if they don't, who want everybody to have equitable chances to survive and thrive. Mm-hmm. The most radical feminists I know have no problem with the fact that I used to play football, that I drive a pickup truck, that I present in fairly masculine ways, that I like to split wood with an axe. None of that requires me to be dismissive of things that are stereotypically female or mm-hmm. feminine. None of that requires me to expect deference from Shannon, my wife. None of that requires me. I just don't see how that equation works out. Like, if you are asking men to be this particular thing, if you're asking them to not consider violence as an option, you're feminizing them. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And for those of you who can't see, I made a very quizzical look with my face, like a what the hell look. It just doesn't, I can follow the line of thinking that thinks that happens. I don't agree with it. Mm-hmm. I can see how a person would connect those dots, but I think past a certain point, it just becomes a struggle to justify not having to care about certain people in like ways you want to. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes any sense. I just thought about this. There's, you know, the musician Iggy Pop. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's a photo of him in a woman's dress once. You don't think he identifies as trans or as a crossdresser or anything. He just had on a woman's dress, and he's got a really nice body, so it looked good on him. Mm-hmm. And someone was like, "Oh, aren't you? Don't you feel weird about that?" He said, "I don't think it's shameful to wear women's clothing because I don't think there's anything shameful about being a woman." Right. So when I hear people saying, by asking men to be conscious of women in ways they haven't always had to be, you're emasculating them. That to me is just evidence that you are asking men to give up their sense of primacy. Like, why would you ask men to take women as seriously as men? Like, I've had like older women say that to me, Chris. There are just things about men that I think are more serious than women. Like, women like frilly things and girly things, and you shouldn't expect men to like that stuff. Well, no, I don't want anyone to like that stuff if they don't want to, right. But they don't have to see it as being taken less seriously.
Right.
There is nothing that's more, like, I like bicycles. I like my pickup truck a lot. I don't own guns, but if I were going to hunt, I would own guns. I also like to sew. I just got a sweet new sewing machine. It's an old vintage one.
Nice.
And I don't take any of those things more or less seriously than the others. To me, that's what it comes down to. When someone says you are emasculating me or you are emasculating him, it means you are asking him to be conscious of and be respectful towards something you don't think he has to be conscious of and respectful of. Does that mm-hmm. make sense? Mm-hmm. They're not contradictory things. You can be a quote-unquote real man and take quote-unquote girly girls just as seriously as you take your bros. Mm-hmm. And if you can't, that's not because the thing you can't take seriously is inherently not worthy of being taken seriously. It's because you feel entitled to seeing it that way. That's my perspective. Mm-hmm. I didn't state any of that as clearly as I want to, but it fits together in my head better than than it comes out in the words.
It's a complicated thing, I think, you know. Yeah. And I think it's that, can we still have men sort of be in this place of power and protectiveness, as some women want to see men that way, some women don't.
Right.
But can we still have that, and can they still be kind and gentle and aware? And I think you're saying that you can. You know, the point is that you can.
I don't see them as excluding one another. Mm-hmm. I also think it's partially about expectations. It's about rules. Well, if you are a man, you should be this thing. If you are a girl, you should be this thing. How do we treat people who say, no, I want to be myself. I want to mm-hmm. be who I am as a human being. Yeah, this is like a 4 or 5 beer conversation.
I know.
Started. I like to approach things like this by telling stories, and I can't come up with any really good stories. But it's partially because my brain is getting a little bit punchy, but also partially because it really just comes down to those most simple concepts to me. I think every person should be free to express themselves how they want, as long as it doesn't hurt other people. And if part of your conception of being a man is that you require women to make room for you that you won't make for them, or if you require them to play a feminine role that is deferential to masculinity, I don't see that as an... I know people who believe that's like natural law and natural order. I don't believe that story. I don't buy it. Because I've seen far too many people who... It's not an either-or proposition. It is both and it's way more than both and. It can be a lot of different things. And none of them have to involve... Like, if any part of your identity requires taking yourself more seriously than someone else, or being dominant over someone else, or minimizing or infantilizing someone else, I believe that's problematic. I think you can be a really strong, stereotypically masculine man who can maybe respond in some situations in ways that a lot of women can't. And you can be partnered with a woman who could protect you sometimes. Shannon's better at some kind of confrontations than I am. I'm bigger than her. I'm stronger than her. She's way tougher than I am. Mm-hmm. She is capable of being a lot more assertive than I am. And I think that makes us a good team. I don't think that emasculates me. Mm-hmm. I don't think it defeminizes her. I think it means I am me and she is her. And I'm not going to expect her to dumb herself down or pretend she has a weakness she has just to prop up my sense of masculinity. Mm-hmm. I can lift a lot more firewood than she can. And she can stare someone down way better than I can. There's some things I just don't buy. Mm-hmm. And I don't buy the fact that being a man has to revolve around being someone to take more seriously in any way. That's what the whole protector role is. That's part of what that is to me.
That conversation is, I think, an important conversation that mm-hmm. it's hard for people to have.
Yeah.
And to think about and to figure out what does that mean to them. Because we've got so many cultural things coming at us and opinions and ideas, and it's hard to process some of that stuff out.
Yep.
You know, and we don't have a lot of spaces to do that.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you sharing your thoughts on that. This conversation could go on for, like, literally days, yeah. years. Do you have anything else that you kind of want to throw out there for folks to either think about mm-hmm. or know or that kind of thing as we go forward in life and thinking about this subject a little bit?
Yeah, this is something I'm thinking about all the time. People find out I do this work, and one of the most common questions they ask is, does it work? And my understanding is what they usually mean is, do the groups you work in and have worked in cure guys from being violent? And the basic response to that is absolutely not, partially because that's not what they're set up to do. They're not set up to fix people or cure people. They are intended to be one aspect of a broad community response to a deeply embedded community problem. The question usually comes from, in my experience, a perspective that says, guys who use violence against women do that because there's something wrong with them as individuals. And there's very often a lot going on with them as individuals. They've got chemical dependency issues. They've got unresolved trauma. They've been abused horribly. They've been mistreated horribly. They've got job and housing insecurity. I've rarely met a guy who shows up in the work I do who hasn't experienced his own multiple forms of trauma. None of that helps in his process of learning not to use violence, but it doesn't cause the violence in my experience. One of the reasons I believe it is comfortable for people to see violence as an individual pathology issue is that it means people who run those programs can help those guys, and it sequesters that off over there, and it takes the responsibility off of everybody else. Mm-hmm. And so the one thing I would want everybody to know is that if we truly want a new norm where no one uses violence against anyone else, we can't just rely on a certain program or a certain system to fix that problem, because just responding to the people who have used the violence doesn't take away the social norms that lead to the violence and that support the violence. That is very difficult for a lot of people to hear. And there was a time when I would have reacted to that really indignantly. Well, I'm not violent. I don't support violence. I'm actually against violence. I now see that differently. So I think if for people who really want to play a role in ending, you know, domestic violence or other forms of violence, start learning about the social norms, the embedded social norms that empower and embody those types of violence, and work to change them. Because it's not about just fixing individual human beings. It's about fixing a culture.
Love it. Well said.
Thank you. I tried to be concise.
Thank you. This is fantastic. I appreciate your time and doing this, because I think it's such a huge and important conversation. And I think we need to have it in multiple ways and multiple times. But this is really great.
Same. I said about 4% of that in the way I wanted to say it. And I'm going to be questioning all of it for multiple days. So please consider all that a rough draft.
I love it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you again, Chris, for being so open and so willing to share it. Something that I think we all benefit from. And I just have to say, I absolutely love the story that Chris tells about going home to his wife, Shannon, after doing this work for a few years and explaining to her how some men take women less seriously. I have heard that story before, and so I knew it was coming. You probably heard me laughing. But it's just delightful, and it speaks so much to Chris's ability to just see himself as he was and is, and again, it's fantastic. He tells amazing stories about Shannon. Shannon, I have never had the chance to meet you. We've been in the same room together, but he paints an absolutely delightful and amazing picture of you. So hopefully at some point I will get to have the opportunity to meet you live and in person. Oh, and if you are a sucker for cute puppies like I am, check out the Facebook post, or hopefully you got the email. If you're not signed up for the email list, go to wellnessrenpodcast.com and sign up, and you too will get emails and pictures of Chris's dog. Adorable, adorable. It's always good to begin and end difficult topics with puppies, preferably real live ones, but when you don't have the real live ones, sometimes pictures just have to do. Thank you again for listening. Check out the podcast at wellnessrenpodcast.com. Have a wonderful week. Until next time, may you continue to find pieces that fit thoughtfully and productively into your health and wellness puzzle. Take care. See you soon.